Hey everyone, it's Duncan Crary. You're listening to The Kunstlercast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl featuring James Howard Kunstler. Jim is the author of The Long Emergency, The Geography of Nowhere, and the soon-to-be-published Too Much Magic. For today's podcast, we're going to play something that we recorded in front of a live audience, especially for The Kunstlercast, during the Congress for the New Urbanism, which was held this May 9 through 12 in West Palm Beach, Florida. This is a conversation between Jim and John Norquist, who's the president of the CNU. And after they talk for a few minutes, we open it up to questions from the audience for both of them. Now, you might notice there's some noise on Jim's microphone for the first few minutes of the podcast. I ended up swapping out his mic, and that little kind of rumbling, bumping sound goes away pretty quickly. So just suffer through it a little bit. Some of you might not even notice it. Welcome, everyone, to a live recorded episode of the Kunstlercast from the Congress for the New Urbanism in West Palm Beach, Florida. I'm here with Jim, of course, we'll hear from him in a minute, and John Norquist, who is the president of the CNU. Thanks for joining us, John.
My pleasure.
Okay, so Jim and John, I figure you guys can yak for about 10 minutes, and then we're going to open this up to questions from the audience. This is a really casual, informal, last-minute thing, but we have a pretty good crowd. So what do you guys want to talk about?
Well, I want to run something by John and maybe turn this into the basis of a conversation. But especially, I want to know what he thinks about this, both as the director of this organization, the CNU, and someone who lives in America's second city, Chicago. And it's this. You know, I've had this theory for a long time that we're facing a really new disposition of how we inhabit the landscape of North America, and that we're going to get in a lot of trouble with the big cities, and that the action's going to be moving to the small cities, that the North American economy will be much more internally focused on North America, the whole inland waterway system will be much more important, but that the big cities are going to face problems that are going to be every bit as difficult as the suburbs, in particular the issue of skyscrapers. You know, I feel that we will discover that they're liabilities and not assets because we're not going to be able to renovate them. And I wonder how you feel about sitting on your perch on Randolph Street in the Loop and seeing this, seeing all of these 30-story condo towers being hoisted up in downtown Chicago and what it means and what you've been thinking about it.
Well, I'm in a 16-story building, the Marquette Building, which is right across the Federal Plaza from Doug Farr's office, which is in the Monadnock Building, which was the last gravity-supported high-rise without steel structure.
It's a masonry building.
It's a masonry building, and his building, I think, is 11 stories, 12 stories.
And the walls at the bottom are like 14 feet thick, and then
yeah,
they taper going up.
They would be capable of a howitzer couldn't knock through it on the first shot. I mean, it's a good place to go if there's bullets flying.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll go there.
All right. So what do I think of high-rises? I'm not convinced. I've heard you talk about them before. I'm not convinced they're quite as doomed as you do. I think Manhattan, New York City, will figure out how to get enough electricity to run the elevators. There's lots of ways to produce electricity. I just read the Amory Lovins article in Foreign Affairs. I don't know if you saw that, where he's talking about the fossil fuel industries are like the whale oil was in 1858 when the country was dependent on whale oil for lighting and all kinds of stuff. And then suddenly, even though it was about to run out, catastrophe was about to hit, along came petroleum.
That's an old story, though, and I'm not sure. That's the old succession of fuel story, and I'm not so sure. That it isn't just based on
I'm not going as simple as you think. I think you're right that there's going to be an energy challenge. I don't think the transition to wind and solar power is necessarily going to solve all the problems. I'm just saying that Manhattan, with all the money and power it has, will find ways to light up and do the elevators. I think that high-rise buildings On the suburban fringes, I think high-rise buildings in Des Moines, Iowa, there's not going to be skyscrapers built there. There's not going to be skyscrapers built in Libertyville, Illinois, Adlai Stevenson's old hometown. We have one of their developers here. That's not going to happen. The mid-rise is going to come back. Mid-rise meaning like five, six stories max. I'm just saying the catastrophe as far as the really big cities that have lots of concentration, they will find ways to get electricity. That's my view.
Because I don't think it depends on the electricity really so much as the fact that the capital is not going to be there. And that would get to like another question I have, which is, in as much as I think that the capital scarcities and that the problems of capital formation are going to be extreme in the coming decades, I don't see how the cities, the large municipalities that are organized at a certain scale and with a certain amount of servicing stuff can possibly pay their way and keep themselves running and repaired in the future.
Well, I saw this when I was mayor of Milwaukee. You know, the whole subsidy game of public-private partnership, that's where the private person makes the public treasury their partner. And it becomes mandatory if you let it. And so you get all these buildings that don't make sense, you know, in cities like, you know, Decatur, Illinois doesn't need skyscrapers. Bloomington, Illinois doesn't need skyscrapers. Syracuse, New York has skyscrapers. It doesn't make any sense. And those happen, like that ridiculous shopping center that Pataki, conservative Republican Pataki, wants a shopping center in Syracuse. What was it, $500 million, $700 million subsidy for that?
Oh, there was billions when all was said and done.
It's still not open.
Well, it's sitting there rotting. It's sitting there rotting. There was originally a giant shopping mall there called the Carousel Mall, built by one of the most notorious and predatory mall builders in America, which was ironically named the Pyramid Company. Can you believe it? You know, life imitates farce or something like that. And they managed to winkle all this money out of the state, and the city of Syracuse bent over and picked up the soap for them. And they got totally hosed. They built this giant addition to the Carousel Mall, which is now standing empty. It's the size of an aircraft carrier. And it was a really cute kind of idea. The idea, and I get this, let's say you're trying to sell a political idea. Here's your idea. You go to the governor of New York and you say, you know, I think we can make all these people from Scranton, Pennsylvania, and Worcester, Mass., drive all the way to Syracuse to buy sneakers and eat a hamburger. Because, like, they can't find that anywhere near Scranton or Worcester. And you know, that seemed to me to be the absolutely most preposterous idea. And, of course, you know, it turned out that, you know, of course, nobody's going to drive 180 miles to buy a hamburger and a pair of sneakers. Because, you know, they can get sneakers in their own town. But that was the basis of that, and the thing is sitting empty now.
That's over. I agree with you. The city's bending over and grabbing the soap. They're not going to be able to afford to do it because they're not going to have the capital. They can't tax people. In order to provide even the semblance of basic services, they're not going to be able to hand checks to people for projects that make no sense. Now, the good thing, the bright thing, is that local officials are waking up and they're saying, what adds value to my community? Well, what adds value, like government infrastructure, like a giant road, doesn't add value to that community. So whereas a street grid with small block sizes and all that stuff, that can add value. That's the place where you can actually sell real estate, and that's where you can have value so you can afford to have a fire department, things like that. Now, that is a really positive trend, and that's good for new urbanists because new urbanists can work at that scale and help add value to these communities.
Well, I think that a theme is emerging in this conversation, which is there are various points where my own notions about the future depart from some of the assumptions of the CNU, and that always kind of fascinates me. And I think the CNU has gotten into trouble over related things.
What'd you think of our obsession with the environment about 4 or 5 years ago, where we got, so that was the only issue we wanted to talk about for about a year or two.
Well, it was sort of consistent with the general theme in the USA, which was let's spend the next half decade blowing green smoke up our ass.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, we just joined
well,
in the
we almost changed
fiesta.
Our name to the Congress of Sustainable Urbanism, yeah. CSU. Well, that would have confused everybody that had a CNU logo on something would have had to change it. That would have been wasteful anyway.
Well, good. We didn't do that.
You could have cashed in on that.
We almost did, but not quite.
But I want to run another assumption by you. You know, the CNU, in its infinite attempt to be polite to all the other stakeholders in the built environment, have done everything possible to bend over backwards to accommodate cars. Because I think for, you know, a reasonable understanding that the American public and the people who build for them are simply not willing at this point to entertain the possibility that the cars won't be there forever. But it seems to me that, you know, we are really on the threshold of the twilight of motoring. And that, and also because we face all these capital scarcities, that we just can't afford to keep on making these giant investments in parking structures and things like it. And I would like to see the CNU get a little bit more radical about that.
Yeah, I mean, you're basically talking about an organization that's trying to fit into the marketplace, and so it gets a little shy and that stuff. Plus, we have, you know, Robert Davis and Andres Duany both own cool cars, and they like to drive their cars. And Andres always makes the point that it's not whether you own a car, it's how much you drive it. If you own a giant Escalade or something, you can use that just a few times a year, and it's fine. If somebody else has a hybrid and they drive 12 hours a day, they're going to cause a lot more problems. So you have those kind of discussions. But, yeah, I think we do need to, particularly when it comes to parking, car storage. We need to be more militant. We have Don Shoup, who we can learn a lot from, the high cost of free parking. I think we're getting better on that. I think we're having some impact on local officials. Parking ratios are changing. Even big box retailers are starting to loosen up their parking ratios. So I think the issue is starting to change. But we should push the change faster. I agree. I confess, I admit error.
Okay. Well, I'm not trying to punish you or nothing.
Okay, so what do you guys think about opening up for questions from the audience
now? Fine.
Okay. All right, who's got a question for either Jim or John? And I have to hold this mic because it's noisy. So just come up and I will hold the mic for you.
It's the rumble mic.
Yeah, it's got a loose connection. Okay, cut it. Okay, I'll hold it for you. By the way, say your name and where you're from.
My name's Katia Hansen. I'm currently from Miami, most recently with DPZ. So my question is, you were both talking about energy, and John, you were kind of saying that, you know, everybody talks about energy and the jump to oil and the problems with that. But the way that I've been viewing it, and that I'll actually be talking about in the session directly after it here, is the power concept. So we went from manpower to horsepower to water power, and it was this multiplier effect. And all of the systems that rule our lives and you know, support our lives basically are based on this multiplier effect. And you know, sometime around the Industrial Revolution, it went exponential. It wasn't just an increase in the multiplier effect; it went exponential. So for me, that's more of the thing you talk about. You know, we can find a way to power elevators, you know, in New York, but how are we going to run the tools to keep the streets, you know, operational, or, you know, like when we simply don't have oil, which provides, I think the ratio is one tank of gas is equivalent to 4 years of human manual labor. So
you're saying we'll run out of magic solutions and we might actually have to deal with, okay, I agree with that. I would word it a little bit differently because it's hard to sell scarcity as a political issue. And let's face it, a lot of what our discussion that we comes out of our of new urbanists is trying to deal with the world of politics. We need to start thinking of energy in the way Republican conservatives think of labor productivity automatically. Oh, labor productivity, that's a good thing. Maybe a lot of Democrats do too, unless you're like in the, you know, one of the unions, maybe you want to say, have not as much productivity, so you spread the work around. I had a job like that once that had a union that told me to slow down a little bit. But that happens. But we don't talk about energy productivity. If you get more production out of the same amount of energy, that's called productivity. And instead of trying to teach the right-wingers and the oil industry, instead of trying, well, the oil industry, that's a whole other matter, but instead of trying to teach the right-wingers that they have to accept the fact of global warming and whatever they thought before is over, they have to do exactly what people in the environmental movement tell them, that's what really pisses them off. It's like, oh, that trumps whatever you were saying. Shut the fuck up. You are done. You have to do what we say. You have to have transit. You have to have all that because of global warming. That's what they hate about it. That's what they don't like. That's why Gore isn't popular with them and all that. They don't like that. So it's about energy productivity. It's about adding value to the economy. It's about getting more for more output for less inputs. And if and that's the way you can sell it. You can sell it lots of ways to different people, different audiences, but that's what we need to do with energy, because it can't be a case of the magic solution. Oh, the magic windmill. Oh, the magic sun and all that stuff. That I agree with Jim on that stuff. There are limits, but then probably the biggest source of energy that can be produced is productivity.
I just want to add two things to look at this from a slightly different angle and maybe to correct some, I think, a big mistake that our culture is making very broadly. It's this whole econometric idea of efficiency and, in particular, energy efficiency. The people who are talking about these things seem to be unacquainted with Jevons paradox, which is essentially an economic law which states that the more efficiently you use energy resources, the more of it you will use in aggregate because more people will be using it more efficiently. And it appears to have been proven unerringly during the entire industrial age. And so we're sort of misspeaking when we haul out this term efficiency as the end-all and be-all of what we can and will do. But more importantly, and in a larger way, I think that the more troublesome issue is the idea of economic growth, especially as it's understood in terms of capital finance. And I hasten to make a distinction between capital finance and the chimerical thing that people call capitalism, which they seem to think of as a belief system and is not a belief system. You know, capital behaves in a certain way. It's about the behavior of surplus wealth. It's not about what you believe about surplus wealth. That's a different matter. But we speak about growth and argue about growth and debate it and make assumptions about it. I would simply assert that it's very important to understand that we're really talking about economic activity. And activity should be the operative word. And then the question is really, what kind of activity is it going to be? Is it going to be a continent full of people driving around purposelessly, constantly and incessantly, just driving around and motoring? Is that going to be what our economy is? Or are we going to actually do other things like make things of value, grow food in a way that is actually healthy and is and local? Those are ways that I think that we're going to get more out of really repurposing our economy. And so the big debate about growth ends up just being a mug's game.
Okay. Well, the way growth is counted, things that are valued. Just take healthcare, for example. There's a mass confusion about healthcare. The United States pays enormous amounts of public tax dollars for healthcare, twice as much per capita as England. England's at 7% of GNP for total healthcare expenses. That's including whatever anybody would pay privately. In the U.S., it's 18.5%. But the argument here is we can't afford to have the government involved in healthcare because then it'll make it more expensive. It's because everybody thinks, well, anything the government does makes things more expensive. Not always true. And just like what Jim just said about energy and, it's not, if you have more efficient gizmos, but then you just use them more, then you'll have that problem. I think I'd like your reaction to this. In terms of settlement pattern, which is our biggest issue, that would be our contribution to reducing the energy and the carbon profile and all that stuff, is settlement pattern. If we had a settlement pattern like Western Europe, we'd be using half of the energy per capita in the United States that we presently use.
Yeah.
I think that that would not be affected by that theory that you mentioned. I forgot the name.
Jevons paradox.
Jevons paradox. I think it wouldn't be, because it's the occurrence of the energy wasting things goes down.
But
so
you know, there's a whole realm of other considerations that go beyond.
I'll buy it for
that go beyond
solar just, vehicles or something.
It goes well beyond the whole question of fuel and costs of things. It has to do with the fact that the places where people live in Europe are places that are spiritually nourishing places that have a huge amount of decorum and are constructed with artistry. And the thing that is most characteristic of the places in America is that they have no decorum whatsoever, and we are completely unconcerned with the artistry that goes into constructing them, other than the engineering. And so, you know, we've managed to create all these places that people just hate. Or don't care about, and they actively discount the idea that they don't have any vested affection for the urban habitat, because they've never seen one that actually works for them.
Are you guys ready for another question?
I guess. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm sort of.
Sorry.
Yammering.
Just say your name and where you're from.
John Harris, A5. You started the conversation talking about cities, and obviously John Norquist, former mayor of Milwaukee, living in Chicago, CNU based there. You were recently in Northwest Indiana. I read a little bit of your blog.
The horror
of Gary, Indiana, and Whiting, et cetera. So you guys were talking about...
How'd you like that skywalk?
You're talking about the future health of cities, but there's a lot of talk today about regionalism. So how does the future of Milwaukee, Chicago, and Gary, Indiana, how do they intersect? And does the health of Chicago depend on the health of Northwest Indiana and Gary, or does Gary not even matter anymore?
Serve the ball to John.
All right. Actually, I think that the solutions are not that complicated. Northwest Indiana has a beautiful, beautiful waterfront, which they, of course, destroyed to build the steel mills in a different era. And the heavy industry now at this point is not as important as it was. There's still a few steel mills and coke plants left, but the ability to restore the waterfront all the way around from the Wisconsin border to the Michigan border is not beyond the realm of imagination. I think it could actually happen. It doesn't require enormous funding for that to happen. The other thing is the state of Indiana treats Northwest Indiana like it's the enemy. Part of that may be the racism that Indiana has some history with the Ku Klux Klan had more members there than any other state in the country. But some of it's just stupid. I mean, they spend more money on highways and they let that South Shore line languish. If they had more trains running faster, it takes two and a half hours to go from South Bend to downtown Chicago on that train. It would take about an hour and 10 minutes by car. So if they improve the trains, they would be part of the wealth of Chicago, much more a part of it. They'd have commuter traffic, all kinds of things that would happen that would be good if they would better connect. Does Chicago need Gary? I think Chicago would benefit a lot if Gary was healthier. 100 years ago, Gary was one of the richest cities in America, and it has the city hall and the county building are next to each other. They're beautifully built, great buildings. And then they have this dumb skywalk that goes out one side and ends up dropping you in an empty lot with a lot of glass and stuff in it. There's beautiful homes all through it, but they have almost every bad policy you can imagine. And Gary's been selling itself as a rotten place for years. We're really rotten. We're about to go bankrupt. Give us more money. Hey, it's even more rotten this year. Can you give us more money this year? I mean, with that kind of message, Gary's not going to go anyplace.
Well, I want to talk about the larger issue of regionalism, which I think is also in that...
Sorry about that.
Star Wars Somebody phone. Which I think is part of the that immense bundle of misunderstanding and poor assumptions that America is carrying on its back. You know, the idea that we're going to see regional governance, for example, and regional coordinated, you know, systematically coordinated regional planning, I think is a fantasy that's going to leave a lot of people disappointed. Because the direction in all of these matters for the decades to come, I think, is going to be for stuff to be smaller and smaller and smaller, and the scale to get finer and finer and finer, and more and more and more and more local. So the especially the idea that we're going to see large metroplex these large metroplex organisms become even more complex than they are now. Because we're now in a phase of history where we desperately need to decomplexify the stuff that is overcomplexified, and the economic analog of that is that we're now in a systemic, comprehensive, compressive contraction that is going to go on for a long time. So the real task for the future, including the future of governance of whatever it is that you're attempting to govern, is going to be the whole issue of managing contraction, and to do it in a way that does not allow society to become destructively disordered.
Can I insert an agreement? I want to talk about the regional side. The regional planning as a magic solution doesn't always work. It does if you have a region that actually self-identifies, like Salt Lake City, and you
there's
bring
nothing
in,
else
you
around
in,
that.
You bring some. I'm not. Just let me finish. Portland, where they bring in a guy like Calthorpe, and they have a way of communicating with the people that works. But regional planning in Milwaukee was a disaster. It was basically just a auxiliary department of the Wisconsin DOT. And they wanted to build highways, and they were just continuing the same crap. When I was in the legislature, I sided with the most right-wing members of the legislature, even though I was a Democrat, to cut the funding for the Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Planning, every chance I got. I even held out on a budget once and got their budget cut by about 10%.
Yay.
They hated Milwaukee. They hated black people. They didn't hire minorities. They had their office in a cornfield out in Waukesha County, and it was 4.5 miles from the nearest transit stop, and they're supposed to be the regional planning office. So, you know, it's not a magic thing. If you have a regional vision, you don't necessarily need a regional planning agency to do it. And so you can still have a regional vision. The smaller areas do matter. If you're a city, you shouldn't look... Oh, if we have metropolitan cooperation, but you're not going to have metropolitan cooperation in Detroit. There's a few guys like Mark Nikita, the mayor of Birmingham, and owns property, a lot of property in Detroit. He loves Detroit, but he's the exception. The suburbs in Macomb County, they don't like Detroit. I mean, politically, they really don't like Detroit, and they treat it like crap. And the state, the Michigan DOT, the Regional Planning Commission of Southeastern Michigan, they've been a disaster. They ripped out the transit, built the freeways, ruined the place. So Jim's right. You look smaller. The street, the block, the local facilities, maybe the port. You know, I was trying to figure out how to answer your port thing, because my first reaction to it, you're talking about rebuilding these ports. I ran a port. I was the mayor of Milwaukee. I appointed the port director. He worked at my pleasure. If I wasn't pleased, he was out. We were the only port on Lake Michigan, large port, that actually made an operating profit, and he was so proud of that. I said, where's your capital expenditures? Where's that? Oh, we don't count that. I just operating profit. I said, no, wait a minute. So it's just the operating profit? You know, he said, yeah, everybody else even loses on that. There's no reason to have these big ports to service ocean-going vessels in Lake Michigan. But what's missing? All the little stuff. Before the Jones Act, and I won't go there because it's too complicated to talk about, but back in like 1937, there were more than 60,000 commercial boats on the Great Lakes west of the Niagara Escarpment, the four Great Lakes. Now, there's just over 60. 60.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole thing disappeared because the federal government came in at the request of the ship industry, and particularly the Manson line that goes from Hawaii to the United States. It's a monopoly they control, and there's another line that does Puerto Rico to the U.S. It's destroyed small shipping. In order to do what you're talking about, in order to have these small ports come back, you have to eliminate all this whole layer of crap.
Well, I think what we'll really see, and I've said this about building codes and zoning laws too, is that they're really unreformable, and that in the future they'll simply be ignored. You know, we're going to reach a point where you simply can't, you can no longer afford to pay attention to those laws. Plus, the government will not have the resources to enforce them anyway. So, you know, they will emergently and organically kind of return. I just want to say one more thing about the regional visioning process. You know, the reason that this is it's a fantasy, and an interesting fantasy sort of from the group psychology standpoint, is that we think that this idea called visioning is a substitute for a consensus. In other words, agreement among all the individuals in the society who have some commonly agreed set of ideas about what's okay and what's not okay and what are standards of excellence and what are not. And we don't have that. And so, you know, we come along and we try to supply that artificially with these visioning processes. And we never, you know, it's like if you go back and look at the building that was done in American cities in the Beaux-Arts period and how fantastic it was and the artistry it represented. And these were done entirely without design review boards because there was a consensus among the people who developed the buildings and built them that you couldn't do it below a certain standard of excellence. So they just didn't. So, I think we'll get back to that in a sort of backwards emergent way.
Okay.
Yeah, so my name is Chris Turner. I'm a journalist from Calgary, Alberta, the wonderful booming oil capital of Canada, corporate oil capital of Canada. My question kind of builds from what you were just talking about and the way that these systems can no longer serve us and gets at something Peter Calthorpe said this morning about, you know, working with the Chinese is refreshing because at least they're fact-based. And so as we talk about, you know, what seem to be some pretty cataclysmic changes, climate change, energy scarcity, a bunch of others we could all name, it's simply not going to be possible, I don't think, to get full consensus on any of these things, particularly in the United States, before people need to begin to act. So, you know, are there ways, like John was saying, where, you know, you talk about the same outcome using different language and motives to try and force people who don't want to play by environmentalist rules to actually do the stuff that needs to happen to build the infrastructure of this next thing?
Well, to some extent, there are two parts to that. One is that, three parts to it. Part one, life is tragic. There are not necessarily happy endings and happy outcomes. Part two, people who don't act in their own self-interest quickly enough sometimes have to be dragged kicking and screaming by reality into their own future. And part three is sometimes they fail. And they just don't. And then, you know, civilizations and societies just decay and go to hell. You know, I think personally the process will be emergent in the sense that, conditions will assert themselves. People individually and in groups will understand at some point, at some set of inflection points, they will recognize that they have to behave differently, and then they'll start behaving differently. But it's that old Schopenhauer idea, really, that new ideas are greeted first with ridicule, and then violently opposed, and then accepted as self-evident. You know, it's a three-way process. And that seems to be going on in the United States right now. The principal characteristic of the presidential election is that both sides are campaigning to sustain the unsustainable. You know, that's what all this bullshit about 100 years of shale gas is all about, and the idea that we're going to just continue running this economic machine the same way that it's been running, in, you know, and basically supporting the status quo. But eventually the conversation will change, and the political parties may even change. And I think the dangerous thing, and the thing that I've been concerned about most for a decade, is the basic question of how disorderly does this have to get in our society. You know, if we fail to make certain arrangements and take certain actions, it will get very disorderly. We are, you know, I've said this so many times, and I'm sorry to repeat it, but the stupidest thing that we're doing right now, in my opinion, is failing to rebuild the conventional railroad system. You know, it's probably the easiest project that we could do collectively. It's not that expensive. It would be hugely beneficial to everybody involved.
And Warren Buffett invested heavily in.
Fuck Warren Buffett. We need a better consensus than just one old Kooten, one old pirate out in Omaha, you know, investing in a particular line because they're hauling a lot of shale a lot of coal out of Wyoming, you know. But we really got to do. We can't get this thing together. We cannot drag this issue into the political arena. Nobody gives a shit about this. And believe me, this is a large piece of territory occupy. We're not going to have trouble getting around it.
The political defensiveness, basically you have the Democratic Party knows better and is afraid to do the right thing, and a lot of the Republican Party is delusional, and they're insisting that they're right, and I think there's a real danger to our democracy. The extreme events you're talking about could lead to something like fascism at some point.
Sure.
And, you know, I used to say that, I don't want to take credit for making this up, but somebody said that liberals should adjust their opinion toward gun control because of the upcoming civil war. I mean, it could get, you know, it could get that bad.
Well, I'm a registered Democrat, and I have the New York State handgun license. And as a character in one of my own novels said, a piece in the closet is a great comfort.
Okay, I think we have time for one or maybe two more questions. So you had one. I gotta hold it. Okay. I went to college for this.
No bad. So my name is Craig Chester. I'm covering the conference for Next American City. I live in Miami, Florida.
I knew some legitimate press person would show up here.
I wouldn't go that far.
Can I take back about half of what I said?
So I live on the 23rd story of a new condo building that I rent the condo in Miami, and it's a city where these giant 50-story condos sprouted up, I think Jimmy once said, like fungus after a spring rain, which is exactly what happened. And I think from my perspective, probably before the energy gets really expensive to run the elevators, it's probably going to be the housing associations, which I find to be pretty flimsy
now,
that will probably encounter some serious crisis more quickly than, you know, the oil cost is going up, so maybe you could speak.
We've talked about this on the podcast before, and I wrote about it quite a bit in my forthcoming book, Too Much Magic, coming out in about a month. And this is a very important idea, is that, you know, you put up a gigantic megastructure that is deconstructed legally into different ownership units, and then you need to have some kind of an organization or homeowners association, legal entity, that takes care of the building. And what happens is if you have a megastructure and there are a certain number of vacancies or foreclosures, or this legal entity just cannot come up with the resources to keep the building maintained, these buildings will not be maintained.
Okay, and there's another factor involved here, and that is something CNU is working on, and that is what we call the Live, Work, Walk initiative, where we're trying to get the Fannie, FHA and the HUD 220D programs, all that stuff, they have assigned risk to mixed-use development, and put a cap on how much non-residential you can have. That basically has made Main Street illegal in most of the country, in all of it. The only way you can build above retail is if you have you go way up, and so that's why you get high-rise buildings where you'd never expect to see them, and the economy can't support them, and people don't ultimately want to live in them. You can get that. You can do that in the Upper East Side of Manhattan. There's a natural market for that stuff, but when you see high-rise housing in medium-sized cities around the country, it's because the developer can't sell those condos or get financing for the apartments because the banks mimic all the stuff the feds put out, and it gets in the way. That's part of the problem. It's not the only part of the problem. But if we fix that, why did Main Street get built out? You look in the 1920s, all these beautiful Main Streets all over the country from coast to coast, and the banks financed them fine. You want to have a business on the first floor and a couple apartments above, fine. Hey, you're spreading your risk. If the business doesn't do that well, you'll still collect rent from the apartments. That's the way the banks looked at it. They've now been trained by FHA and the rest of them. Oh, my goodness, you're going to mix something in there? That might fail. So we're not going to give you any financing for it. That's what the regulations basically tell you. Don't do it. And once that's gone, the market can help support that change.
Well, you're also describing something which is very perilous for a culture, which is when you load a tremendous cargo of stupidity on the software that runs your culture. You know, it ends up being like a Microsoft operating system that's just burdened with so much bad code that they can't run. And that's sort of where we're at.
There's two industries that are most prominently oversubsidized in America. One is housing and the other is healthcare. And both of them are they're like a disease. They're swelling. Their share of GDP is higher in the U.S. than it is in most other advanced countries. And that's a symptom of the interference of the government forcing capital into them and forcing it in a way that's ultimately toxic.
So there.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have time for one more question. I would like to put the women in the room on the spot and ask if any of you have a question, because it's kind of a sausage fest on the ConcertCast. And okay, we have one. We have one adventurous female voice. Just say your name. Where are you from?
Hi, I'm Bonnie. I'm from the Toronto area. So just going back to the whole, actually, it kind of takes in the regional government as well as the skyscraper issue, because the Ontario government has the Great Growth Plan, which is the Golden Horseshoe area, which is very vast now. It goes from Oshawa, Clarington, all the way up to Barrie in the north, the Lake Ontario in the south, which is Toronto, and the Niagara Falls on the west side. And I think it's 2014 or whatever, all these different regional communities like Mississauga, Brampton, et cetera, have to do these densities. So targets. So the problem with the whole issue is that their vision of targeting, of meeting these density targets, is to build up. So right now there's 185 towers that are in that general area. I'm saying Toronto, not the Golden Horseshoe, but the greater Toronto area, which is actually a little smaller, that are under the construction stages right now, which is the highest anywhere in the world. So I know Jim's position on the tower issue, but what's CNU, can you just clarify? Because there are actually several people from the Toronto area who are at the conference, and they're saying, well, that's CNU. That's their CNU position, is the, like the T6 urban core. However, can you just clarify if that's really your position to go into the skyscraper realm?
Skyscrapers, Jim and I'd probably have I know we'd have a difference about skyscrapers in Toronto, the core of Toronto. But I don't think that it's a good idea to have skyscrapers in the periphery around Toronto. And the reason that's going to lead to seven-story car garages and all kinds of things that are unsustainable. You can have fairly high densities without going way up. And I think in the long run, the market will support that. I think you're better off going that route. And that government position that wants to have, the mayor of Toronto seems to be obsessed with big. You know, big. He doesn't like streetcars. He likes, the only trans he likes I like both subways and streetcars. He only likes subways. And he likes big roads and all that kind of stuff. that gigantism is something that seems foreign to Canadians. You know, I mean, Jean Drapeau tried it in Montreal, and it didn't work out so well for him. And you know, so you should. I think you're right to resist it. I think most new urbanists would say that this. You know, some would say no, like Diru Tadani's a real anti-skyscraper. Leon Krier's a real anti-skyscraper guy. But you get to, you know, the consensus position in CNU is that really tall buildings should only be in the places where you'd have the infrastructure and the density to support them. And you don't have that in the surrounding areas. I mean, there's no reason to build a 30-story building in St. Catharines or Oakville. You know, but that's what your plan, that's what it sounds like they want to do.
Hold on.
So how tall do you mean tall in the urban core? We're talking downtown Toronto. Are you saying 30 to 50?
In downtown Toronto, you know, I mean, they've already pierced any reasonable limits. But let's talk about, you know, the other places. I don't see any reason to go above 6 or 8 stories when you're talking about a suburban location. Even if it's served by transit, you can get really high density levels at 5, 6, 8 stories.
I really think that we do have to categorically get away from high rises. I guess my one feeling about this is maybe what you would call a historical view of what we're doing. And it can be summarized in this way, that societies do what they do because it seems like a good idea at the time. And it's often no more complicated than that. It seems like a good idea at the time, and you're able to do it for technical reasons, for one reason or another. You know how to do pretty good reinforced cement, and you know how to stack stories on each other, and you know how to maximize the floor to area ratio of a building plot. So you do it. But you know, the tragedy of all that is what seems like a good idea at the time in one age ends up being a supremely bad idea 50 years later. And that's the predicament we're in, that the ideas that seem good and normal, you know, in one era are now going to come cascading down on us with consequences. And I don't think that we are capable of changing our assumptions about it. That's why I keep on coming back to this, you know, idea that we're going to be dragged kicking and screaming into behaving differently. And no amount of argumentation and rational debate is going to persuade people. You know, for example, the architectural community. You know, it's quite clear that an architectural firm like Robert A.M. Stern's firm. He sent some of his boys to a panel at the National Arts Club in Gramercy Park. I was on a panel with three guys from his office, and it was during the period of blowing green smoke up our ass, and they were presenting their green skyscraper, which I think was the Condé Nast Tower or the New York Times Tower, one of those things, and you know, they were very proud of it. And you know, the whole thing is obviously a complete contradiction in terms. You know, a green, sustainable green skyscraper. It's just absurd. And yet I don't think that you can persuade an office like that to not try to maximize the floor to area ratio, because after all, you know, if they design a 7-story building and their fee for doing it is $900,000 versus putting up a 73-story building and their fee for doing it is $16 million, you know, it's quite clear what the incentives are for them to do that. Plus, a developer has every incentive in the world to maximize the floor to area ratio. So, you know, it really comes down to maximizing the floor to area ratio. You know, it's a very simple econometric, and, you know, and it's almost impossible to argue rationally with these people about it. You can't do it. So.
But where the land prices are lower, it makes no sense to go high, even from an economic standpoint. So I think the Toronto issue is one where this is maybe a strained analogy, but I have to make it. If you look back to this port issue, look at Charleston, which is now going to build this giant shipping place for the Princess Cruise Lines, which it has to be subsidized because the Princess Cruise Lines has to go all the way to the Bahamas from Charleston and touch them before it can then go to Florida and then go back to the Bahamas because of the Jones Act. And And so they're going to build this huge, unsupportable thing. When the Jones Act rules finally become so obsolete that people don't obey them anymore, that whole thing will be a complete waste. And just to give you an idea, John O'Hara wrote Butterfield 8 in 1931, and the plot is the movie Butterfield 8, where you had Liz Taylor fall in love with some rich guy. She was anyway, at the end of the book, she hops on a packet boat that's going to Boston. There's regular packet service. All the cities on the East Coast all have them, several boats a day going up to Boston, going down to Baltimore, all that. She gets on one of those boats, and then she's so depressed, he jumps on the boat. She throws herself into the wheel of the boat on the back and dies. By 1954, when the movie was made, there were no boats. There's no scheduled service anymore. They did it on Highway 1, which is a freeway in Connecticut, and she runs into a bridge abutment and dies, and he's driving behind her. You couldn't even do the plot of that book anymore, and it was those rules that came in and did it. And the rules right now in Canada are probably saying, hey, that's great, build a 30-story building in St. Catharines. Those rules are not sustainable. It's going to fall apart. It's going to be a mess, and you should fight it.
And by the way, you know, it's really humorous when you look at the assumption that carnival cruises will be some kind of normative middle-class behavior in the years to come, because the idea that there are going to be enough people who have that kind of money to just go piss it away on a four-day buffet at sea, you know,
but it used to be nonsensical. It used to be you could, before all this stuff happened, you could take a cheap boat, cost next to nothing, and ride a boat down to Savannah.
Yeah.
You know, on a little day cruise, and the average working person could afford it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I want to thank you both for this conversation.
That's it.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. This show will be posted on the web maybe in a week or so. If you've never heard the podcast before, you can find it at kunstlercast.com. I'm Duncan Crary. I wrote a book earlier this year based on my four years of...
You said it was better than his book.
No, that was someone else. Anyway, it's based on my 4 years of conversations with Jim, who can talk about anything and be endlessly entertaining forever. So there's like 50 copies of it upstairs, so please buy them. So the book's so. Okay. Anyway, thanks a lot. I'll see you soon.
You've been listening to the KunstlerCast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can listen to all of our past programs, join our email list, find out how to book Jim to speak in your area, and talk about the show with other listeners at kunstlercast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.
Hey, Ben.
You can talk about how you do it from Chicago.
Do me a favor, because I'm paranoid. Look at my recorder and make sure it's recording. Are there numbers moving?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
All right. Now, remember, all of you have to write your questions down, and you hand them to the censor, and then any questions we find embarrassing, we'll eliminate, and then we'll...
No.
Actually, okay. you can say anything you damn well.
Especially because it's a podcast.
Yeah.
We don't have any commercial advertisers or anything.
Well, we have some. We have a few.
Oh, we do. That's true.
But they don't tell us what to do, Jim.
But they're all crazy people, so it really doesn't matter. They're selling crazy things.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to edit this out.
including this motherfucker who wrote a novel. And one of the blurbs on his book that he's advertising on my website says much better than Kunstler's novel. Remember him?
Yeah, I do. But you know, I live off pinto beans and Frank's hot sauce, so I had to take the money. Okay, welcome everyone to.